are you working on something new that is maybe especially for the Internet of Things or smart home devices, or is it can the CyberConplex be used for or against, whatever perspective you want to take, those kinds of devices and services as well?
Yes, well, CyberConplex has been in continuous development since last time we spoke. However, what's changed is the landscape of devices that represent a threat to people has also changed throughout. We're now seeing quite a problem in Airbnb communities, whereby people staying in other people's apartments are finding drop cams and similar wirelessly enabled cameras being used against them without their knowing. And this has presented quite an interesting new position for CyberConplex as a traveler's security device. I've since added a lot of other cameras that are traditionally known for just, you know, home security and the like. I've had to add those to the list such that people can at least sweep and scan for them even if they don't decide to actually disconnect them.
So what's your opinion about smart homes in general? I mean, will those technologies improve our lives, or are they kind of a first sign of a dystopian post-privacy future?
I think it presents certainly a great deal of whole new challenges for privacy, if we do take privacy seriously. But simultaneously, we have to ask ourselves, which kind of smart home do we want to have? Do we want to have a dumb home, or do we really want to have a smart home? I mean, the idea that, which is very much a Silicon Valley idea, that connectedness is always good, needs to be held in suspicion. We need to ask ourselves, what are we connecting to and why? So we can have a smart home that, for instance, hosts the would-be cloud in the home itself. There's no reason why we can't actually serve from home. There could be smart home products which allow for the data to be stored actually physically at the site. And then a person can connect to that home server when they are abroad, if they like, and keep an eye on their home or whatever, or activate or you know, deactivate certain features in their home. There's no need for it to all be stored on private property in a outside of a jurisdiction in which that person pays tax, held by private people that they've never met, used for all sorts of purposes that they have no idea about. The idea that the cloud is a necessary partner in crime, you might ask, in the smart home industry needs to be held in suspicion too.
So you say there's actually no need for cloud services all the time. Still, those concepts are reality now. A lot of people use it, and most people don't really seem to care about it. What's so attractive about this concept?
Well, the cloud is purely a fixture of convenience. The idea is that one need not actually store the data locally. One need not necessarily take care of it. It's taken care of by someone else, somewhere else. But people don't think of the somewhere and someone else. When we think of clouds, which is a very patronizing children's book image in itself, we think of this thing that belongs to everyone. It's up there, it's ephemeral, it belongs to no country, it's deterritorialized, you could say. But in fact, what a cloud service is it's someone else's computer. So we need to ask ourselves, what are we connecting to, why, and what are we putting onto other people's computers? And so the cloud is attractive in its simplification, but it's not necessarily the convenience that we always think it is. In fact, sometimes it's convenience with quite a significant cost. That cost is not communicated.
What's that cost? Can you explain?
Well, for one thing, the data that is being collected is by no means your data. You see a representation of that data. You might see a distillation of that data, almost like a boiled down, dehydrated version of it. But you don't necessarily know which of any of the black boxes in your home are what they're actually collecting. you might see a representation of the of your power usage and the different light fixtures that you've used and the toaster that you turned on, the oven that you turned on and when. But there could be a tremendous amount of other information being collected. Microphones could be activated or deactivated without you knowing. I mean, we've already seen endless scandals of that sort over the years. And more so, that data could be being cross-correlated with your appearance in other contexts where there are other devices owned by the same companies to chart your movements that could be then of interest to an insurance company or potentially to an employer or future employer that would like to have an idea about where you are based and your movements and pay a premium for that access. Medical information could be freely shared as the company is bought and sold, and all that stuff happens in the background and we have no access to it or any updates, status updates if you like, as to those changes.
Some interesting, some interesting statement from the German Chancellor. She recently, she recently described data as an important resource in the 21st century, and she also warned about a predominance of privacy that could harm the industry. So what's your thought on that?
Well, to say that data is a resource is instantaneously a generalization and a dangerous simplification. To say that data is a resource is to liken data to water or air, which is to say that your data is the same as the air or in the air or like water and therefore belongs to everyone. But in fact, your data doesn't belong to everyone. But to position data that way, I mean, if someone is to walk up to you on the street and ask you your name, you would have every right to tell them to piss off, as we'd say in New Zealand. You'd tell them to go away. If they were to ask where you were born, your mother's maiden name, your age, similarly, you would feel, affronted. You'd say, no way do I have to tell you that information. But that's your data. But when we think about data in the electronic sense, in the digital sense, somehow we forget that it's connected very much to people. And people hold on to that data. And as the Cypherpunk's manifesto so beautifully put in 1993, privacy is the power to selectively reveal ourselves to the world. We choose what we give and when for reasons that we keep for ourselves. And it's an important function in society as we know it. Even in our family relationships and relationships with friends, there's things that we will say to some that we will not say to others. We choose. But to generalize data, to talk about data belonging to the world like a resource, is to undermine precisely the same things that we enjoy and have enjoyed for centuries. There is very much a war on privacy at the moment, but this is a war predominantly happening in the communication space. Privacy already exists. Privacy predominates already. Privacy is something that we've built societies around and with, and human relationships around and with, as long as we have had societies. And to say that now that privacy represents a threat, well, then I would say that the industries that she's talking about are then a threat, because we would want to think that we were developing progressively. Even it's a difficult word, progressively, but that we were developing intelligently and respectfully as we are adding new industries and economies and ways of communicating forward. But to say that industry is threatened by, for instance, privacy advocates and tools and utilities is certainly quite suspect. I mean, I would go so far as to say that there is a long history of state powers taking an interest in data collection. Since the census, we've had that, one of the very early forms of a database. And this is something to consider this kind of comment. It's a part of a much older history, data collection. Who is doing what and where? Know your populace, know your people. Yes, I'll leave it there.
When we come back to our time now, what could be a solution? I mean, how could or should devices and services be designed to, keep privacy and enforce or giving the at least the decision to people who use the technology?
I don't even think there needs to be a compromise to convenience while maintaining privacy. As I said before, there's nothing to stop us from serving from home. Virtual private networking, for instance, implements a means for you to access a device in your home from outside of your home. And so if we think about building devices, to answer your question, that better protect and safeguard our basic rights of privacy, we need to think about ownership versus renting. Many of the devices that we own now, we don't actually own. We rent. You know that because if you are to, unlike with your bike, where if you buy your bike and you need to change the tire or the wheel or the chain or the handlebars or something on your bike, you're allowed to do that. You're not breaching the warranty of your bike. There's not a little wall of lawyers between you and that action. But with something like a smartphone and many of the devices in the so-called smart home, they're actually not really owned by the purchaser. In fact, they are arguably, in many senses, closer to a rental relationship. So with ownership comes control. And so therefore, the control of that device needs to be handed over to the owner. Things like remote activation by a company across the Atlantic, remotely activating or deactivating devices in your home, well, no, that is not ownership. Firmware upgrades without telling the owner, et cetera, et cetera. Data collection, where the data that the thing collects is being hosted elsewhere and the owner of that device, the supposed owner, doesn't have access to that data. Well, no, that's not ownership. So we need to think about how we relate to these devices as consumers and how much control we have over them. And I would say that would go right down to the ability to inspect the source code, should we need to.
So where do you think this all leads to? Because if we look back at the last couple of years, it seems like people get used to not having control. People get used to giving away their data. When it comes to smart homes and the Internet of Things now, what's your, well, not prediction maybe, but what do you think will happen? Why should it change? Why should the behavior and the what people do about losing control, why should this behavior change now?
Well, there is such a, I mean, you know, why should they change? Well, there is such a thing as negative adaptation. I mean, not all adaptation is positive. And I do see a far too willing, an increasing willingness to accept things that we certainly would never have accepted 10 years ago. It feels like now you could tell people that that the state or a state interest or agency necessarily must put up a camera in one's home, in one's lounge or bedroom even, just to help protect the security of that home. And it feels like now in just a few years you'd see people even accepting that. And this is something obviously we would think as an absurd science fiction premise or a dystopic premise. People will, I mean, there is also that story of the frog that's put into water and the water is heating up very, very, very slowly and the frog boils in the water, which may or may not be true, I don't know. But in this case, thinking about this problem, I don't think people will change until there are stories, for instance, of a malware attack on 500,000 homes where people are locked in their homes or ovens are turned on remotely by a hacker. Where a house is flooded and someone is electrocuted because of remote activation of a water pipeline or service or something like that, or a smart lock, which I cannot believe it, but there are Wi-Fi enabled smart locks out there, which is just absolutely insane. I mean, jammers are cheap; you can buy Wi-Fi jammers real cheap. And until there are actual tangible effects. We hear stories of, and there is certainly evidence to suggest that that there's a tremendous almost black market in the background of the trading of data in between companies that collected and insurance agents, employee services, or career agencies and the like, and I do believe that that is already shaping people's lives without them knowing it. But again, it will take something relatively scandalous, just as we're already seeing with automobiles, Volkswagen, of course, recently, but even quite scary things, attacks on cars that put the pedal to the floor and send the car crashing into whatever's in front of it. It will take things like that before people will actually step back, because convenience trumps, as we say in English, convenience always wins over common sense.
But those things are, well, they will happen. I think it's
inevitable. I mean, there is no precedent in a history of digital technology, in the age of the internet. There's no precedent to suggest that there is ever a condition of unanimous and continuous safety. I mean, the more integrated systems that you add to your environment, the more attack vectors, the greater that the attack surface actually increases. By adding complexity, you are adding simultaneously vulnerability. If that ownership is not contained within the very walls of what you call your home, then you are letting other people into your home, whether you like it or not.
Great, thank you very much.
A pleasure.